Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In the United States, 6,000 schools are located in flood zones. Here in California, 1 million kids had their learning disrupted during the 2018-2019 wildfire season. While the discourse around the climate crisis is finally changing, is it changing in our schools? How are young people learning about what's happening to our planet and the forces behind it? According to a 2019 poll from NPR and Ipsos, more than 80% of parents in the U.S. say they support the teaching of climate change. That amounts to 2/3 of Republicans and 9 out of 10 Democrats. 86% of teachers believe climate change should be taught in schools, but 60% do not teach the issue because they believe it's outside of their subject area. There's a new report out from the National Center for Science Education, and they found that just 27 of the 50 states and the District of Columbia have standards that earned a B+ or better for how they address climate change. 10 states received a D or worse, and they include some of the most populous states in the country, including Texas and Florida. The majority of state standards are clear that climate change is a real and serious global problem and that human activity is responsible for it, but the reviewers express concern with a failure in many states to be explicit. And we just learned, thanks to the Daily Californian, that the Berkeley Unified School District's Board of Education unanimously passed a climate literacy resolution, committing $65,000 to developing a new climate change curriculum for the district over the next 18 months. The passage of the resolution is the first of its kind among school boards nationwide, according to Sarah Rennie, a co-author of the resolution and a parent, as it includes a financial commitment rather than just a declaration of support. So if you're a teacher or an educator, how do you teach climate change? If you're a parent, does your child learn about the climate crisis in school? And how do you manage their feelings of anxiety around these issues? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet at yourcallradio. Today, we're joined by three guests. Dr. Christina Kwok is a social scientist and an expert on climate change and girls' education. She's a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution, and she has a really important report out that she co-authored called Unleashing the Creativity of Teachers and Students to Combat Climate Change, an Opportunity for Global Leadership. Hi, Dr. Kwok. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having me today.
Great to have you. Kimmy Waite is a social justice educator. For the past 2 years, Kimmy has connected her kindergarten students with National Geographic Explorers through the National Geographic Educator Explorer Exchange. Kimmy Waite is a Public Voices Fellow at the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication and the Op-Ed Project, and a 2021 California Council for the Social Studies Outstanding Elementary Teacher of the Year. Hi, Kimmy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Julieta Rodrigo is a certified climate science educator. In her former role as program manager at the nonprofit, the Clio Institute, she educated students, teachers, and the public about the climate crisis. Hi, Julieta. Thanks so much for joining us again.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me back.
Great to have you. Well, Dr. Kwok, I want to start off with you because you co-authored a very important report for Brookings called Unleashing the Creativity of Teachers and Students to Combat Climate Change. And it was so great to read this at a time when we're having, again, a very low bar conversation, unfortunately, about education in this country. And one of the statistics you cite is really amazing. If only 16% of high school students in high and middle income countries were to receive climate change education, we could see a nearly 19 gigaton reduction of carbon dioxide by the year 2050. So Dr. Kwok, can you talk about the power of teaching young people about the climate crisis?
Yeah, absolutely. And I totally agree with your assessment of this low bar at the moment that we are at least globally in our discourse around climate and education. So I think, you know, the statistic that you pointed out is from a great body of research led by Eugenio Cordero over at San Jose State University in your neck of the woods over in California. And it's just a testament to how our current conversations around climate change, closing the emissions gap, is missing a vital component. And that's really the need to close the education gap. And when we talk about the emissions gap, you know, we're talking about our anticipated, projected levels of greenhouse gas emissions and where we want them to be if we want to see a 1.5 degree target met. And when we're, what we're not talking about is this, is this education gap. And that is where we really need to see the knowledge, the green skills, the climate consciousness, those levels at a certain point in order for us to even be close to, you know, exhibiting or adopting the kinds of behaviors that are needed to help us achieve the 1.5 degree target. And as you pointed out, you know, if we just had 16% alone of students in middle and upper middle or upper high income country context taking, you know, climate change courses and learning about climate change education, its solutions, its impacts, we could really see mindset shifts and worldview expansion that's necessary for people to really take the kinds of actions that are needed to address the climate crisis.
I love how you put that, mind shift, a mindset shifts. And you write that imagine if 100% of students around the world received an education like this. Can you elaborate a bit and just talk about how that would result in so many changes? Because I love another study you cite from Ecology and Society, and they looked at 125 countries. Researchers found that the death toll caused by floods, droughts, wildfires, extreme temperature events, and extreme weather events could be 60% lower by 2050 if 70% of women were able to achieve a lower secondary school education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, again, it points to the importance of understanding not only what climate change is and, you know, the climate science behind it, but really understanding the root causes for our current crisis. And that's, you know, that includes our, you know, energy usage, our transportation choices, our food choices. But importantly, it's the underlying systems that support these kinds of choices. And without an education that really helps us to begin seeing and understanding how interconnected our different social and economic and political systems are and how they, you know, fuel the kinds of behaviors, consumption patterns, production behaviors, you know, all of these different things, we really can't make the massive shifts in our ways of being that are necessary to actually be able to move the climate needle. You know, it's really about enhancing people's understanding that yes, there are individual actions that need to be taken, but most importantly, it's transforming our systems. And without education to help us understand, you know, understand the full scope of that and to develop the critical thinking skills, the strategic thinking, the systems thinking, we're going to be stuck making incremental changes. And what we need is really the transformative changes. And that gets at, you know, really enhancing students' ability to see the deeper structures that are at play.
Julieta, can you talk about how you see this play out in the classroom? Because when you worked with the Clio Institute, you educated students about the climate crisis.
Hi, thank you. This is Julieta. I see this playing out really well in the classroom from my experience. When we come in to talk about climate change and we come in with a perspective in which we want to hear what the students have to say, we do see a shift in the conversation. We're able to help students connect the dots on their own lived experiences with the things that climate scientists are telling us that are occurring. So many of the times we go into schools where students are dealing with issues like flooding in their communities or extreme heat or disproportionate air pollution levels. And we're able to help them make those connections between what we're doing in terms of human industry and how that's disproportionately impacting all kinds of different people.
What about you, Kimmy? How do young kids respond to information around our planet? For the past 2 years, you have connected kindergarten students with National Geographic Explorers through the National Geographic Educator Explorer Exchange. So tell us how this plays out with very young students.
Yes, thank you. This is Kimmy. I would like to kind of comment on what Dr. Kwok and Julieta mentioned, and they're both touching on larger social systems that impact students and their experiences with climate change. My teaching experience has been in South Los Angeles, where my student population would be predominantly Black and brown. And the students, you know, when we're talking about global issues like climate change, they might not be able to articulate things like systemic oppression or environmental racism, but they notice some things in their environment, like, you know, the water being contaminated, inequity in terms of parks near their school and in terms of tree coverage, then trash and pollution, and then also living in a highly trafficked area. Mm. So I think when you're talking about global issues with students, it's important to localize it as well and to recognize their immediate context. So, for example, in the National Geographic Educator Explorer Exchange, which pairs a teacher with a National Geographic Explorer who is usually a scientist, my kindergartners worked with a marine scientist from the Philippines named Arena Molina, and she studies a marine mammal called the dugong. And we worked with her to kind of engineer a net and boat prototype, which would help the fishers prevent bycatch. So inevitably, in talking about, you know, this global issue in the Philippines, the students realized that, you know, a lot of them had not been to the beach. A lot of them do not live close to the water. So I think it's important to have community experts locally and globally that students can work with to contextualize this. And then also what we want is, I think, intergenerational collaboration to address these issues.
Kimmy, since you brought up the examples with the young people that you teach, you have a really important piece in GRIST, which we'll talk about later. Bills banning critical race theory also threaten climate education. And in the piece, you write that even in kindergarten, kids understand that water can be contaminated. They're hesitant to drink from the fountains at school. Instead, they carry plastic bottles because they're, quote, clean. They can articulate that there's trash in their neighborhood, and they wonder if it's like that everywhere. They're curious about where the trash goes. You write, when we study maps, they notice that there aren't a lot of green spaces around their houses. They know they live in an area with heavy traffic and make comments about the smell of gasoline. And again, we're talking about kindergartners here.
Yes, that's correct. I think a lot of the times we have a deficit mindset when it comes to younger learners and what they're capable of understanding, mm-hmm. and even what's, I guess, appropriate for them. But I think, you know, younger learners are very keen to understand larger issues dealing with fairness and equality and even equity. And they're usually the first ones to call out when something is not fair, and they can realize that. So whether it's, you know, whether there's parks near their school or, you know, what's happening in their neighborhoods, they are very quick to realize when something is not right. And I think as educators, we're primed to kind of tap into that and work with students to create intergenerational solutions, and then also work with community experts as well.
So these issues are coming up on a regular basis. And I wonder, Dr. Kwok, when we talk about educators and teachers, 86% of teachers believe that climate change should be taught in school, but 60% say they don't teach these issues because they believe it's outside of their subject area. So can you talk about that? Because the issues that Kimmy is raising, I mean, when you're talking about kindergarten, it's one teacher who has to deal with so many issues. So how can we start to ensure that teachers have the tools that they need to really address these issues?
That's a really great question. This is Christina. So I think this just really points to the absolute critical importance of ensuring that our teacher professional development systems are supported as we really try to amp up climate change education. And I think, you know, the statistics that you point out really speak to also some of the misconceptions, I think, that are out there, mm-hmm. that in order to teach climate change, we're teaching climate science. And while I think that's, you know, true for the sciences, we really need to begin to understand how to make connections, interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary connections to climate change that really leverage teachers' existing knowledge of the world based on their, you know, disciplinary perspective or based on their, you know, the different entry points that they might have in their classrooms. And so, you know, this means ensuring that the English language teacher, you know, has the opportunity to use resources for teaching how to read that are on environmental concepts that touch on the climate crisis, you know, or ensuring that the art classes have an opportunity to allow students to, you know, draw out how is it that climate crisis is making them feel. And then from there, have open a discussion around solutions, you know, and I think, you know, it gets back to some of the things that we talk about in our report, and that's really trying to have conversations around teachers, teacher training, teacher professional development that essentially unlocks quality teaching, quality education, project-based learning, experiential learning, and really begin to have new ways of thinking about bringing real world, relevant, community-based challenges with the climate crisis into the classroom and using a cross-disciplinary perspective to think about how we might understand it better, how we might connect the dots between our science classes and the discussions that are going on there with the social studies, the histories, you know, the pieces that Kimmy was talking about in terms of, you know, trying to understand some of the systemic structures of inequality and oppression and exploitation that have kind of led to certain kinds of experiences for certain communities and certain neighborhoods. So, you know, I think what we really need to begin to focus our attention to, and what I'm, you know, so delighted to hear that, I think you said the Berkeley District Schools or Berkeley County or something was right. actually putting financial resources to this to develop curriculum and materials. They must absolutely focus on the teacher training aspects too. So I think it points to that.
It's so true. And yeah, this is the Berkeley Unified School District. This just happened last week. Again, they're committing $65,000 to developing a new climate change curriculum. And Christina, this is the first resolution of its kind among school boards nationwide. So it sounds like sometimes there's a declaration of support, but there's no financial commitment behind that support. Is that the case?
Yes. And that's where we really have to move on our collective advocacy. When we're saying to policymakers and leaders in our communities, we need to, you know, integrate climate change education. We need the budget to back that up. We need the financial resources to really help support the material development, the teaching and learning materials, the teacher professional development, the opportunities to bring hands-on learning into the classroom. All of these things require finances. And if we're not including that in our conversation, we miss, you know, an important step off point once we have the policy, you know, the policy win that we want with the inclusion of climate education in the classroom. We really need to ensure that there's a budget to follow.
Julieta, can you talk about the power of organizations like the Clio Institute, which educates students, teachers, and the public about the climate crisis in Florida, connecting with schools? And do you know, how common are these kinds of relationships? Because it seems like that would be a really great way to support teachers and really bring in great materials, because that is the focus of an organization like the Clio Institute.
Thank you. This is Julieta. At the Clio Institute, there are a multitude of programs that do work with students and with teachers and the general public. So Clio was founded in 2010 by a science teacher. Her name is Caroline Lewis, and she founded it with the knowledge that there was a lack of a scientific understanding and climate literacy in Miami, as well as the entire state of Florida. And she had an ambitious goal of increasing climate education, and she came in with her background as a school educator, and she brought that into the programs going forward. We have different programs within the Clio Institute. Among them is a formal program called Climate Resilient Schools. within that is probably my favorite component of the Resilient Schools program. It's called CLIP. And CLIP is an acronym, stands for Climate Leadership Information Program. And it was inspired by a high school student who came to CLIO and said, I need your help to bring more climate education into my schools because my peers do not understand the urgency and we're not seeing the level of climate literacy that we need in order to address the urgency of the climate crisis. And so we worked with the students to rearrange the programs that we had and have this peer-to-peer education system. I think it's a really successful initiative when organizations collaborate with schools. So the Resilient Schools program under the CLIO Institute is an official partner of Miami-Dade County Public Schools STEAM Department. And we've been working with them to incorporate more climate education into the classrooms. All of our climate presentations that we give to students align with core standards so that teachers feel comfortable inviting us to be a part of their day as well as incorporate it into what they're teaching. And the simpler we can make it for teachers to incorporate climate, the more successful I think we're going to become. We have different teacher workshops that help teachers incorporate climate into their classrooms, regardless of the age level or subject that they teach. So I think the partnerships that you were mentioning are integral to creating a big change within our school systems.
Kimmy, can you also talk more about that? Because you work with the National Geographic Educator Explorer Exchange, and it must be an amazing experience to watch scientists and people doing, you know, incredible things, talking to such young people about, you know, whether it's the oceans or animals. So can you talk about the power of these relationships?
Yes, this is Kimmy. So the National Geographic Society has an education division, and then they have an educator certification program. And I'm a National Geographic certified educator, then I'm also a trainer for their in-person programs. So I recommend becoming a National Geographic certified educator. And they also have a great suite of free online profession development courses. And specifically working with experts, I think as a teacher, there's so much I can teach students, but working with the expert really makes it come alive for them. Mm. So, for example, in that program, the Educator Explorer Exchange, I've had the opportunity to work with two scientists, one local in California, Dr. Joe Cutler, who is an ichthyologist. He studies freshwater fish. And then Arena Molina, who is a marine scientist from the Philippines. And I think working with both of these experts allowed students to not only see the issue personalized, but then it was also like they had a friend who was helping them with global issues, whether it's, you know, marine mammal bycatch in the Philippines with the dugongs, which we are helping Arena Molina with, or whether it was redesigning dams in Gabon, which is where Dr. Joe Cutler does his work. So, and I think partnering with experts, it gave young students the confidence to know that they have solutions, and then the confidence to know that, you know, the scientist who's out in the real world doing this work wants to know what a five-year-old in South Los Angeles thinks. And, you know, they value what a five-year-old thinks about the problem, and they believe that their minds are a great resource that the scientist needs to help them solve the problem. So I think there's a lot of power in partnering children with experts like this, and then not only children and experts, but then also involving the teacher. And the teacher kind of serves as like the translator between the class and the experts. So, for example, the way we structured it was my students would meet once a month with the scientists. And this was a partnership for the course of a school year. So we'd meet over Zoom, and then the scientist would, you know, give us a presentation or talk about their work. And then as the teacher, I would be connecting this in class. Like, for example, when I was working with Arena Molina, we would be learning about dugongs. And like Dr. Kwok and Julieta both mentioned, the power of interdisciplinary learning. So my class did a lot of interdisciplinary projects, learning about dugongs in writing and, you know, in geography and in art. And then working with Dr. Joe Cutler, they did a lot of art projects around learning about different fish species and also, you know, ocean temperature increases and how that affects fish populations. So I think the interdisciplinary focus also allowed students to further internalize this across different disciplines and subject areas.
It must be also so empowering for the students to actually have access to exciting and new information. Because, you know, I've talked to some students in San Francisco, older students, who would often say, I feel like we don't talk about issues that are connected to my life. I'm talking about mostly students of color. And they say it's just not relatable. And so it must be empowering to actually watch these students be exposed to something new. Can you just give us a couple examples, Kimmy, of some of the experiences you've had with some of the young kids?
Yes. So I guess, for example, working with Irina Molina and learning about the dugongs, students learned about like the difference between dugongs and manatees, and then also some of the effects of climate change and how that affected dugong populations, such as the increase in ocean temperature affecting seagrass, which the dugongs eat. So that's one example. And then, you know, being a five-year-old and being able to articulate not only that this is, you know, an endangered species and why it's endangered and how climate change affects that, I think was very remarkable for kindergartners. And then they felt such confidence in being able to articulate this and then not only articulate, but participate in kind of a global dialogue around climate change and climate solutions. And then also working with Dr. Cutler, the students, they designed dam prototypes out of cardboard and recyclables. So one thing in my teaching philosophy, having always worked in Title I schools, is that I want students to know they can make a big impact without a lot of money, and that it just takes innovation to be able to develop solutions. And so students use cardboard recyclables, and then they kept engineering notebooks, and then they redesigned some dam prototypes that would be better for fish species and would also kind of help in a global context as well. So then, you know, working with a scientist, students could articulate global issues, and then they developed a solution, and then the scientist then kind of critiqued and provided feedback for that solution. So for a five-year-old also, you know, being able to hear from a scientist that, hey, this is like a real solution that actual scientists are working on to help this global issue, really gave them confidence and allowed them to participate in the global community, and also the school community. It made them very proud to be able to, you know, be kindergartners and do something that like fifth graders or middle schoolers are working on.
Love those stories. Kimmy Waite is a social justice educator. Kimmy connects her students with National Geographic Explorers through the National Geographic Educator Explorer Exchange. Today, we're also joined by Dr. Christina Kwok, a social scientist and expert on climate change and girls' education. She's a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. Julieta Rodrigo is a certified climate science educator in her former role as program manager at the nonprofit, the Clio Institute. She educated students, teachers, and the public about the climate crisis. Today, we are talking about the power of teaching climate change and issues related to our planet in schools. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about the power of teaching climate change and issues related to our planet in schools. It's important to repeat the statistic again, given the conversation we're having right now about public education. More than 80% of parents in the United States say they support the teaching of climate change. Even more teachers believe climate change should be taught. 60% don't teach climate change because they believe it's outside of their subject area. If you would like to join today's conversation, if you're a teacher or an educator, a parent, what does your child learn about the climate crisis? Later in the show, we're going to talk about how to deal with anxiety around these issues, because that's also really happening today. We're joined by Kimmy Waite, a social justice educator. Kimmy connects her kindergarten students with National Geographic Explorers through the National Geographic Educator Explorer Exchange. Kimmy Waite is a Public Voices Fellow at the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication and the Op-Ed Project. Julieta Rodrigo is a certified climate science educator. In her former role with the Clio Institute, she educated students, teachers, and the public about the climate crisis in Florida. Dr. Christina Kwok is a social scientist, expert on climate change and girls' education, and a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. Christina, just listening to Kimmy talk about those examples, in the piece that you recently wrote, you point out that research shows that children can have a very strong influence on their parents' views. The effect of intergenerational learning is especially seen by girls on their parents and especially on male parents and conservative parents. Can you talk more about this?
Yeah, sure. This is Christina. So I think, you know, as you pointed out, research has really tried to understand kind of the intergenerational effects and impacts that talking about climate change issues, talking about environmental issues could potentially play in shifting behaviors and shifting mindsets about the climate crisis. And this is particularly important when we think about how, you know, typically adults are pretty set in their ways when they're thinking in terms of the way they think about the world and the way that they think about how it operates and what's going on. And with climate change being a particularly polarizing issue, and, you know, oftentimes adults might have blinders on when it comes to their willingness to engage in conversations and engage in the kinds of, you know, deep reflections that are needed around our lifestyle choices and, you know, the way our systems are currently structured. And as a result, you know, adults in the room whom we would typically think would be, you know, having their radars open on risks and, you know, what kinds of things to look out for in terms of potential challenges or dangers that might be on the horizon, these blinders are in many ways preventing them to really see the climate crisis for what it is. And so these studies have shown, you know, the powerful impact that young people can have on their parents, on adults, in terms of how they perceive the issue. So I think it certainly points to the important role of youth activists and student activists around the world who have been marching and striking for climate, mm-hmm. And just really points to the power of their voice at this moment.
What would you add to that, Julieta? Because you have experience in working with and educating students and the general public. So what can you tell us about maybe some interactions you've experienced between youth and their parents?
Thank you. This is Julieta. One of the activities that we have as part of our CLIP program is a conversation with loved ones. So after students become more confident in climate science impacts and solutions, we have an activity where they take a presentation to somebody that they love. Now, this can be a neighbor, a parent, a sibling, a significant other. And they start a conversation saying, here's something that I'm passionate about. Can I share it with you for 15 minutes? And can we have a conversation? We have these guiding talking points to help them stir the conversation with questions like, when did you first hear about climate change? Or is this something that you were taught in schools? Have you seen any differences in your community that you think could be linked to climate over the past few decades? And we find that that has been really healing in many families. There are often divisions in what students find passions and what older people around them think that they should be passionate about. And so we definitely find it's effective in firstly, getting the conversation across where students are more honest and authentic about something that they're interested in. It also helps bridge generational divides on climate education because a lot of climate science has come out that they might not have had access to when they were going to school in their younger years. And then it also sort of unites the group. Now, whether it's a social group, like their friends or their clubs, or if it's at home, you know, with their families, we also find that a more cohesive unit comes around, and that makes them much stronger when we have events or when we have calls to action that perhaps a student wants to go attend a commission meeting to speak on a particular item. having the support of the people that they love around them really helps instill confidence in the students, knowing that they have that foundation, and also helps the adults around them understand what it is that they're doing and why it matters.
Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
First of all, I want to commend your guests for what they're doing, and I wanted to just make a suggestion. I was just thinking about this with young people. Unfortunately, I live in Palo Alto, and I'm not seeing an uprising environmentally down here in my community. And I'd love to see more young people, getting out and doing that. But I have a suggestion about the radio program. I think it'd be worthwhile at this stage for public radio stations like KLW, KPFA, etc., to have like a time set aside during the week when youth could come on and have a program of their own on the radio station to go over, you know, what they're doing, what's happening with young people in different communities or where they live, just a report like that. And I think that would be engaging, and it might really appeal to young people who don't have access. They're listening to adults on the air all the time, and they don't hear kids their own age. So I'm just wondering if that might be a possibility.
Greg, that is such a good idea. We try to bring students on the show when we can. It has to be during the summer, because the show's on in the middle of the day. But it is so important to raise and elevate these voices that we rarely hear in the media. Although social media is really changing that, Dr. Kwok. Just to see the young people, youth from around the globe, indigenous youth, really take to the streets during COP26. We've done so many shows about what happened with Standing Rock and Line 3. I mean, there's so many young people who are getting involved. But a lot of the information you definitely have to look for on social media. In fact, we just had that hunger strike. I mean, we're not talking about K through 12 here, but one of the hunger strikers was only 18. What are your thoughts on Greg's comment?
Absolutely. So in a lot of the work that we do, we create space to also talk to youth and learn from them, not only, you know, what is concerning for them, because after all, they are going to be inheriting the planet that we leave behind, right? But really to understand what are the barriers to their participation, because oftentimes youth can tell when they're being tokenized and when they're being brought to international stages to be the token youth voice, to offer, you know, the little bit of passion on the panel that might be lacking otherwise. But when they're not being listened to because the politics of the matter, or, you know, looking at them as just not being, you know, young humans and not necessarily agents of change, you know, they recognize this. And these barriers to participation, meaningful participation, really get in the way. You know, we've spoken to many youth for, we developed a workbook with my colleagues at Unbounded Associates. And we developed this workbook that was intended to really provide a space for youth to engage not only in the skill building that's needed around advocacy and leadership, but to understand what are the political processes, the bureaucratic processes, the boring dimensions of climate governance and climate decision making, so that, you know, they understand what are the barriers to entry, right? And how do you play the game in a way that will get adults to listen? So I think it's building these spaces, you know, whether that's on radio, whether that's in, more public fora, it's vital to include their voices, but most important to listen and to actually take action based on their recommendations, because they know when they're not being listened to, you know, for those with young children, and you sort of placate them and say, yeah, that's a really great point. It's a really great point. But if nothing changes, they recognize that. And I think political leaders really need to begin to understand that they will have to face the judgment of young people who have been marching and who recognize when their demands are not being met.
Julieta, you just got back from Glasgow at COP26, and over the weekend, so many young people took to the streets to protest what was happening inside the halls of power. So tell us more about the youth involvement at COP26.
Thank you. This is Julieta. Yes, I did return from COP. I was a delegate with the Climate Generation a Will Steger Legacy delegation. And I was really honored to represent the youth as well as the frontline community, as well as my employer, the Clio Institute. There were a lot of youth that were raising their voices at COP because it was really frustrating. And I count myself among the youth. I'm 27. And according to the United Nations, we're youth until we're 35. So there were a lot of people that were raising their voices about how exclusionary COP was. We were there as delegates, and we were consistently barred access to negotiating spaces, to platforms in which to share demands and stories. And the drafts that are coming out of COP reflect the lack of youth inclusion. And there is something really important that I learned when I was in Scotland, is the difference between diversity and inclusion. COP invited a lot of students to come and attend. A lot of youth were part of delegations. And so that's diversity. However, if they are not included in decision-making processes, it's not going to have the same impact that they need in order to create like really valid climate policies to get us to where we need to be over the next decade or so. And so students really took to the streets in many cases. There were protests outside of the security lines as well. And that's where many of the students congregated, because they got through security and they were able to be inside the conference venue, only to be told you have to live stream this event because you're not allowed in. Or in many cases, you're not even allowed to live stream this event because it's only accessible to people who are able to get in. So there were a lot of youth groups, many of which are part of YOUNGO, which is the official youth constituency to the United Nations. And there were big marches on Friday and Saturday. There were over 100,000 people raising awareness on this. So it was really amazing to see the amount of youth being catalyzed into action. But it's really sad and upsetting to see the degree at which COP has excluded youth, as well as frontline communities, indigenous activists and representatives. There really is a tremendous lack of diversity, and that shows in the COP draft reports.
Right. And so many young people have been tweeting about this from COP, and you can just search there. There's so many photos and stories exactly about what Julieta is discussing. Let's take one more call, and then we'll get Kimmy to respond. Let's go to Anya, an educator in Berkeley. Hi, Anya. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. I think it's related. I'd love to hear your participants talk about kind of the intersectional issues of race and economics with regards to climate justice. And, you know, I know growing up in the 70s and 90s, you know, environmental justice was very separate from these other kind of social issues. And I think we're at a real place of awakening around it. And so I'd love to hear them speak about that. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. Kimmy, do you want to take that one?
Yes, and you'll have to excuse me, you might be able to hear a car alarm going off in the background. But for any educators, I think resources by the Zinn Education Project are phenomenal. And Anya, they kind of touch on what you're wanting to know more about, the intersections of economics and climate justice. So they're, the curriculum, Zinn's People's History, and then also People's Curriculum for the Earth is also a phenomenal resource, and it kind of discusses what you're wanting to know about. But I think related to the youth direct action, especially at COP26, I think what we need more of is youth participatory action research, which provides students with opportunities to be researchers and then research systemic inequities in their own communities and really examine those intersections. So for example, there's the Youth Participatory Action Research Hub at UC Berkeley has fantastic resources for teachers. And then also the Center for Regional Change at UC Davis has some great resources as well.
And we will put links to those resources. Thank you for that. And thank you, Anya, for your question. We only have about 5 minutes left, and I want to make sure we touch on climate change anxiety. And then, Kimmy, I really want to ask you about your piece, Bills Banning Critical Race Theory Also Threaten Climate Education. Dr. Kwok, do you want to address the question around, you know, how to talk about these issues with young people who are dealing with some anxiety over this, especially the young people who were on the front lines? We just did a show about oil drilling in California neighborhoods. And as is always the case, it hits poor communities and communities of color the hardest. And there are so many health issues directly connected to this. So it's kind of a, I mean, if you're living in one of these neighborhoods, you're directly affected by it, but then you're also reading about it. So you almost have to deal with it twice. So how do you deal with issues around anxiety?
Yeah, this is a hard one. This is Christina. So I think what we have understood from research is that much of the source of this climate anxiety not only lies in how we currently communicate about climate change is this, you know, very, very, you know, the doom and gloom stories, right? And we oftentimes don't particularly pay attention to the solutions or to the really the depth of change that's needed to be able to enact those solutions. So I think, you know, there's that component to understand. But with other research, what we've begun to find out is that a lot of this anxiety, the climate anxiety and the eco grief that young people are experiencing is out of a feeling of moral betrayal by politicians and political leaders who are not taking action on climate change. And so this feeling of betrayal is, you know, speaks millions to the need for the adults in the room to really begin to take action. And again, listen to the youth and change and change things. So I think if we begin to understand that, we can begin to target our advocacy and our efforts to really ensuring that, you know, the kinds of things that we're saying our solutions need to go beyond the individual aspects. You know, there's certainly great literature out there that suggests, you know, if it makes you feel better, by all means, engage in the individual actions that allow you to minimize, or not minimize, decrease decrease those feelings of eco-anxiety and eco-grief. But we have to remember that it's deep systemic and structural change that has to happen. And that requires our political leaders and our politicians to take action. So I think this, you know, the research that points to this sense of moral betrayal is just so vital for this moment as we see so many uprisings by young people around the world, around climate change, to really say, hey, this is going to have significant impacts, not only on the health of our planet, but the well-being of society if we are not taking action. So, yeah.
Well, and also this is related to your piece, Kimmy, about CRT, bills banning critical race theory threatening climate education. At a time when we need massive, massive change, these Republican-led states are trying to ban or censor curriculums in school. You point to one of many examples. Missouri's House Bill 952 prohibits teachers from using, quote, components of critical race theory, and names the Zen Education Project, which is an amazing teaching guide. This is an entire show, but we are getting some emails about this. And I just wonder, Kimmy, how, as an educator, how should we deal with this, like I said, just ridiculous conversation, but it's gaining steam in almost every media outlet around CRT and these bills that are actually banning components of these education projects.
Thank you. This is Kimmy. Yes, great question. I think the whole attacks on critical race theory, I think it brings up several issues specifically related to climate change. Number one, we can't separate, you know, racial injustice from climate justice, and we can't ignore environmental racism in our conversations about climate change. And I think more of that emphasis needs to come across, especially in schools, when the majority of students in schools, public schools, are children of color, and, you know, frontline communities are disproportionately affected by the effects of climate change. And I think also related to this, there is a disinformation campaign around, you know, critical race theory, and also disinformation campaigns around climate change. So I think critical media literacy is something that's imperative to be taught not only in K-12, but also in teacher preparation programs, so that students are able to interrogate media messages and learn, you know, what is biased, what is benefiting a certain group of people, which media messages aim to disempower certain groups of people. And then critical media literacy is also very interdisciplinary, and I think it's a great tool that students and, you know, future activists and future youth organizers need, and also a tool that teachers need to be able to interrogate their teaching materials and say, you know, does this text that I have, does it really teach the true history of the United States, or is it giving like a glossed over version? Is it presenting more of, I don't know, like the Disney-fied version of U.S. history? And, you know, teaching U.S. history is essential to teaching climate justice and climate change, because ultimately the kids are learning about systemic racism, and then that has implications for today that kids are still experiencing.
Well, this, I would love to have you all back, because I think we can spend an hour on this. Just briefly, Dr. Kwok, what's so concerning about this is the Republican Party are going to use this as a tool going into 2022 and 2024. Can you just give us your overall thoughts on what the response should be? I know it's a big question, but just final thoughts in about a minute.
Oh, yes. This is Christina. That's a hard one. My thinking, and this is something that I have been trying to communicate to many policymakers and decision makers globally through the work that I do, is that there has to be an entry point. And it really goes back to how we frame the discussion and how we frame our what the problem of the climate crisis really is. And for some, you know, it is certainly the systemic racism, the environmental injustices, and so on. And that absolutely cannot be forgotten. And it's absolutely critical. But as you all mentioned, in Republican-led states, this just means that our agenda is dead at the door. Mm-hmm. So what are the other entry points for beginning to open up conversation? Because I think it's going to be only a matter of time before we begin to see more Republicans come to this agenda, but on their own terms, right? And we have to get ahead of this and begin to set those terms a bit and say, okay, if it's an economic thing, if it's energy efficiency and energy cost savings, let's talk about that. Let's get it in the door this way. And then from there, really begin to bring in the other dimensions, the systemic issues. Maybe we won't be able to see the critical race theory in these states for a while, but we really need to begin to shift the needle. Our window of time is closing. And if we're not finding some entry point for discussion, we're really going to shoot ourselves in the foot here. So I really believe that moving forward, we have to think about our entry, how we're communicating. What are our entry points? And from there begin that really hard across the aisle kind of negotiations and discussions.
Well, we'll definitely have you all back to continue this conversation. Dr. Christina Kwok, Kimmy Waite, and Julieta Rodrigo, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.